Hello, and welcome to Beat Cafe, a weekly program sponsored by Offbeat Magazine that explores the music scene in New Orleans and the broader reach of Louisiana. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat, sponsor of this program, and I'm the host of this show. Offbeat is a proud sponsor of WHIV 102.3 FM, and I encourage you to visit our website at offbeat.com to see our May issue, which was the Jazz Fest Bible. There, you'll find stories about many of the acts that appeared at Jazz Fest over these past two weekends, including Elvis Costello, Mark Stone, Lily Lewis, Joy Clark, Mia Borders, Jamil Sharif, and Don Vappy, just to name a few. You will also find our music calendar, original photos and videos, and album reviews with your subscription at offbeat.com. Like many of you, I'm recovering from the joyful exhaustion of Jazz Fest. I hope you all had as much fun as I did at the revival of our city's biggest musical extravaganza after being deprived for three long years. Of course, the music never stops in New Orleans, and there's plenty in the weeks ahead, even as we enter the hot summer months. On today's episode, I will be joined by two vocalists who are paying tribute to music legends. First, we'll hear from Leslie McDonald, an actress and singer who will be portraying rock diva Janis Joplin in a musical at Le Petit Theatre de Vieux Carré that opens tonight, May 13th, and runs through May 29th. Leslie has performed on Broadway, and she is thrilled to be bringing Janis's life story and such memorable songs as Me and Bobby McGee, Piece of My Heart, Mercedes-Benz, Cry Baby, and Summertime to the stage here in New Orleans. In the second half of the program, I will catch up with Shannon McNally, a singer who formerly lived in New Orleans before setting her sights on Nashville. Shannon has numerous albums to her credit, and her latest album, The Waylon Sessions, revisits the songs and spirit of Waylon Jennings, a legend with whom Shannon's always had an ongoing fascination. And I'm so pleased to be joined today with Leslie McDonald. She will be portraying rock icon Janis Joplin at Le Petit Theatre in a production titled A Night with Janis Joplin. It'll be running May 13th through the 29th, the night performances and matinees. Welcome to the show, Leslie. So happy to have you here.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So Leslie, Janis Joplin.
Yes. Wow.
I wouldn't necessarily say that so much those are big shoes to fill, as that's a big voice.
Huge shoes to fill.
Yes, and a big voice. So tell me, how did you get drawn to this role?
Well, I mean, I think everyone's drawn to her, you know, if you're a person in America, especially a singer, especially a rock fan. You know, I've been a fan of her my whole life. I have to say, though, until I did the show, I don't think I knew like half of her songs. So it's interesting now that most of my favorite songs of hers, I wasn't familiar with very well before I did the show. But, you know, I think I was always on their radar, having been, you know, in the rock musical world in New York already when they did the show. And so luckily they got me appointments pretty easily. But then it never ended up happening for me because, you know, they went with someone else for whatever reason, or I was doing something else. It just kept not being the right time until Austin 2 years ago, I got to play her. And I just was like, oh, can I do that? I mean, you don't know if you can stand up there and find that scream in you for 2.5 hours until you do it. And luckily, not only I found it, but I like learned from her how to do it. You know what I mean?
That's impressive. You know, when you say find that scream, I mean, Janis's voice, of course, is very powerful. I would think it would be a test on your vocal cords.
Well, and everyone asks me, that's the number one question I get is how does it not tire your voice? But you know what's crazy? It doesn't really tire my voice because, first of all, she's not precious about her singing. So like if something cracks or goes wilder or maybe even ends up sounding better and more kind of off the wall than you expected it to come out. She's not really planning, and it's not that perfect singing like you have to do in a lot of other cases with musical theater or opera where, oh, if it doesn't come out just right, it's not going to be right. It's almost better if you just sing with wild abandon and not be so concerned with the perfection of it. And then that ends up making it better, you know? And also, I think once I figured out where she was singing from, it suddenly became less intimidating too, because she's not really singing from her vocal cords very much. She's singing from a much deeper place in her body. I kind of liken it to the place where if you're in a lot of pain, you might make noise from, kind of deep in your body. So I ended up finding kind of where that lived in me, and then it sort of felt good to let it out, honestly. And I wasn't using my voice much at all. So it's been really a fascinating discovery vocally.
It's fascinating. I know a lot of people, when they listen to Janice's music, find it very cathartic. And so mm-hmm. you're obviously, you know, finding that as well, deep within yourself. So you mentioned, of course, you have played her before. So you have a background in musical theater. Tell me about your history as a singer.
Yeah, it's funny. Growing up, I never really was like a Broadway musicals kid. I was more of like, I listened to rock, pop music and would just sit in my room all day, every day and try to sing along with all my favorite singers. But, you know, they are rock singers and Mariah Carey and Tori Amos and, you know, all those voices of my youth mixed together was what I was trying to sing like. And then I also fell in love with acting. So then when I found out you could study both at the same time, then I started doing that. But I remember when I first went to school for musical theater, you know, I kind of had to, my crash course was like, I've never seen any musicals. You know, I think I had seen like Les Mis and Miss Saigon. So my education in musical theater was, you know, I already loved singing and loved acting, but it was doing them both at the same time that I wasn't as experienced with. And I really, you know, had a huge learning curve compared to other people. But then once I got into it, I kind of hit the ground running with it and loved it and ended up getting to do a lot of different pop rock shows. Like I was in Hairspray on Broadway for 2.5 years. And I'm already such a fan of like kind of dark humor, John Waters kind of stuff. So I felt like that was a perfect fit for like my first big thing. And then I got cast in Legally Blonde and got to do more of like the pop singing, pop dancing, the comedy. And then I got in the original Broadway cast of American Idiot with Green Day. So then that was kind of an even bigger, that was like the biggest deal thus far in my career where, you know, I was performing with the band at the Grammys and getting to really kind of let out that more just the punk rock way opposite of musical theater sound that I knew I always had in me. But I was, you know, catering my voice to these jobs I was getting hired for. So I honestly started to feel most like myself in that industry when I got that show and ended up having a really long, fruitful career with that show. Playing, then going on after the original Broadway cast and playing one of the leads on the tour. And then I ended up helping be on the creative team for the subsequent tour. So then I directed it at Pace University. So that was a show that really kind of felt like a great, great fit.
So how does one study Janis Joplin? Do you watch videos of her singing? Do you read
tons of videos? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I just start with just listening to her. Like I have a dog. And so I remember when I first got the job in Austin, I just, every time I went to walk the dog, which is, you know, twice or three times a day for 30, 45 minutes, I wouldn't listen to anything else. And it almost became like a meditative to where I was just getting her into my, because I'm not really singing along because you're walking down the street. I mean, I'm not afraid to do that. you know, I was just really taking her in and kind of just letting her voice kind of seep into my psyche and my bones. And so that when I did go for it, I really had her in my ear, you know? And then it's so interesting. As soon as you get up there and those lights are on you and the band is going behind you, that's actually one of the lines in the show. As Janice, I say, you know, I never sang rock and roll. I sang the blues. I was scared to death. You know, as Janice, I say, and then they throw this whole band at me and that sound is coming from behind. And I knew right then and there, I never wanted to do anything else. Like that's one of my lines in the show. And it's so similar to the way I feel that you don't really even need to think at that point, you know, you're just down on me. You just start going and that music's going and you're like, well, luckily there's no, you know, not much thinking involved.
So of course, it's not solely a one-woman show. You do have other singers on the stage. Tell me what role they play in this larger production.
Honestly, I think that's what takes this show to the next level. Such a clever idea by our writer-director, Randy Johnson, and these women just take it up a notch, which makes sense because they're all of Janice's biggest musical influences. That's who these women play. So Janice wouldn't be the singer she is without these women. So it makes sense that it elevates the show. In the first number, you know, there's four women there that or three women at the very beginning, but that are her backup singers, the Joplinaires. But then once, you know, I start talking to the crowd about, you know, how I became a singer and my first biggest, you know, influences, then these actresses come out each one and play these different women. So they're Etta James and they're Nina Simone and they're Aretha Franklin, Odetta, Bessie Smith. They're playing all these women and then they have their own numbers. And I also just love, for instance, like Down on Me, I didn't know that that originally was an Odetta song that she covered. A lot of Janis's songs are covers. So it's so fun to hear this actress sing it in Odetta style and then go right into Janis's version. Because you also, it also shows you how innovative of a singer Janis is, because it doesn't sound much like it, but it comes from the same sort of emotional place that originally made her connect to the song, if that makes sense. She's not vocally sounding like it though, you know?
Yes, I mean, she was very distinct, obviously, but it sounds like it's not just a night with Janis Joplin, but a night with some of the greatest female singers the United States has ever produced.
I mean, the end of Act One is this huge, crazy, amazing, like, face-off singing number with her and Aretha, and it's just wild and so exciting. It's one of my favorite moments of the show.
So obviously, you know, Janis was a phenomenal talent, but also a troubled soul in many ways, left us very early in this world. How is that portrayed in the story?
You know, because I'm speaking to you as Janis, you know, I don't talk about, because we don't know what's coming. She doesn't know what's coming. She does have a very, very beautiful speech at the end where I kind of allude to it and just say that I hope I live on forever. And I think at that moment, the audience is inclined and meant to see that she did, kind of in her own way, even if it wasn't the way she thought. And that is sort of our job, to keep remembering her, even though she's not physically here. I mean, you know, I'm swigging on SoCo the whole show. And, you know, I talk a little bit about having to go home because I got too deep into drugs, but that the music kept pulling me back is what I say in the show. So I think it's alluded to, but I think the way it comes across the most in the show is that, you know, she died of loneliness. Like, she died because her man said he was coming and he didn't. I mean, that's the true story. And that night she just couldn't take being alone and OD'd in her bathroom. And then the next morning they found a telegram from him saying, I'm on my way, at the front desk of her hotel. So I think I just try instead to sing from that place of just feeling really lonely and not being afraid to be completely vulnerable about that fact, because that's what made her do drugs. That's what made her drink so much. That's what made her, you know, be with so many men and women. And I mean, that she was just looking to fill that void. And I think that's the place she sang from too, which is why people connect to her so much. It's very truthful.
Yes. We're going to take a brief break and I will be back with Leslie McDonald to discuss more about her role in A Night with Janis Joplin at Le Petit Theatre du Vieux Carré.
The vibe of the city for human rights and social justice. WHIV 102.3 FM.
And we're back with Beat Cafe. I am David Johnson, the host of this weekly program. And again, I'm joined by Leslie McDonald, who will be playing Janis Joplin in a musical, A Night with Janis Joplin, that will be playing at Le Petit Theatre du Vieux Carré from May 13th to the 29th. For more information, I encourage you to visit Le Petit's website. It's Le Petit Theatre, and that's RE Theatre, .com, or you can also find tickets. So, Leslie, of all of the many, many songs that Janis recorded, is there one that you find particularly that resonates with you, or one that stands out, or perhaps one that was more challenging than others either?
I mean, gosh, I honestly can't say there's one song that I get to and I'm like, ugh, this song. I really, truly love every one. I think probably my favorite song now is Maybe. It's so beautiful. It's so fun to sing. And then also the horn section is just like, there's something about a horn section and getting to sing when those horns go that is just super exciting and just feels really good. I would say the song that probably means the most to me is Ball and Chain, just because it's the one I think that got me in the pocket. As soon as I first sang that song full out with a band is when I really got it and really found that part of my body that it's coming from, because there's just no way to fake it. You know, people can sing her songs and maybe do it a little pretty and not really go there, but you can't sing Ball and Chain. You can't sing it unless you go there and you're screaming and wailing. And I mean, the whole thing is like a cry, you know? And so I think that one's meant the most to me, just teaching me her ways.
So tell me about the costumes and the set. Are we going back to the late 60s, I assume? Of course.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. They make the whole band get dressed up too. I always love seeing the band on the first day they wear their costumes. They got all these, you know, afros and suede vests. It's really awesome. Yeah, my costumes are great. I mean, and also they're really comfortable. I mean, like velvet, you know, velvet stretchy pants and with these cool embroiders, bell bottoms, and super comfortable to jump around and get crazy in. And but also just you feel like her as soon as you put them on.
Yes, that's a very distinct style. She was a fashion icon as much as she was a musical icon.
Lots of jewelry. And don't worry, at the very end, I do throw on the big feathers in my hair and the pink round sunglasses. So
that's what all of us expect, of course.
Yeah.
That's the Janis look.
Oh, and you asked about the set. The set's really cool. It's just like you're at a concert. So they just deck it out in like Janis world, but it never changes. You know, it's just the same the whole time. And then we've got some really cool projections to kind of make it more psychedelic and show some images from her life. So
I'm going to go back and talk more about your, like you said, your earlier career in Broadway as well. Tell me about Hairspray. What was that like to be in that musical? That's
fun.
You know, set in the 60s, of course.
Yes. Way different vibe. I was in pearls and a little gingham dress. We got to wear costumes by William Ivy Long, who is kind of like the most legendary costume director besides Bob Mackie, of course, but like for Broadway. And, you know, to have clothes handmade for you by him is kind of was the first time I'd ever worn something that that elevated and beautiful. That show's a workout. I mean, being funny and singing pop music, that was something I already had down, but the dancing in that show, I mean, you are hopping for 2.5 hours while you're singing. I was quite thin back then and didn't have to go to the gym, that's for sure. But what a blast. I mean, it also was the first time that I felt like I was in such a big cast where I sort of fit in so well. You know, all people that John Waters thinks is funny, you know, that was like a good group of people that are still some of my best friends to this day.
That's right. Yeah. When I heard they were going to make a John Waters movie into a Broadway musical, I remember being immediately intrigued and wondering how they were going to pull it off. But of course, I think it's one of the best musicals ever.
Well, and Mark Shaiman and Scott Wittman wrote such good music too. I mean, those songs are just so infectious.
Yes, it is. It's one of those ones where you leave the theater singing the songs. And I'm sure we'll be doing the same with Janis Joplin.
Oh, yeah.
Most of us cannot come close to, of course, capturing her voice. I'm also curious to know, what is it like, you know, you're visiting New Orleans for this production, correct? You're not a native to the city. Are you planning to take this elsewhere to other cities? Is this a role?
I thought you were about to say, are you planning to move here? And I was like, yeah, maybe.
It has that effect on people.
My second day here, I was like, I think I'm going to move here. I just love it here so much. They did this show on Broadway, Randy Johnson, the writer director, and Patty Wilcox, she's the choreographer. They did this show on Broadway and then they did a tour of it. I think they've done a few tours. And then now it's just in that spot where like anytime now a regional theater wants to buy the show, if they can do it, they'll come with it. So you're seeing the show that was on Broadway. I mean, you know, you're seeing the same director and choreography and that they did on Broadway. They just come to whatever city wants them. And to figure out, you know, who of us are available. And I'm glad that they let me into the family and for the second time now.
Have you had a chance to go out and explore much of New Orleans music scene since you've been here? Or have you been busy with rehearsals?
Well, luckily we had daytime rehearsals. So now we're going into the night. So now it might be harder. But also I'm so wired after the show. It's probably a good idea to go at least out for an hour and see some other music. Here, get some other songs in my head. Yeah, I've seen some amazing music. I mean, I got to go to Jazz Fest last Friday and see Lionel Richie and that whole day of music, which was fun. But we've been to Frenchman Street, seen some good blues, some good jazz. My favorite is just standing on the side of the street and watching those brass bands on the street. Yeah, I'm having a blast.
Yes, New Orleans, it's been said that the music comes up from the streets. It's literally part of our oxygen here.
I just lived in Austin, and you know, they call that the live music capital of the world, but I don't really know how they got that name over y'all. I don't know.
We won't debate it.
It feels more present here. You have to go inside closed doors there, you know?
Yeah, we're very, very, very comfortable with where New Orleans stands in the larger sense of musical history.
Yes.
So you said you largely were not largely familiar with Janis, though, until you took on this role. Or was that kind of your first exposure to her?
I've always loved her, you know, but if a song came out, if I was listening to her, like, great, the show, like, let's say all the songs that are in this show, I could only sing along with like 7 before. Like, I didn't know, they weren't in my, you know, like, I remember hearing Ball and Chain or what's another one, Down on Me, and I'm like, oh yeah, I know that song, but I couldn't just sing along with it. And now it's so in my body that now I, you know, the Peace of My Heart, Bobby McGee, those are great songs, but they aren't my favorites anymore. You know what I mean? Also, I don't know if I answered this before, but I've been watching her doc. When you asked me just how I got to know her, I've been watching that documentary, Little Girl Blue, like over and over. And I really love her interviews with Dick Cavett. I feel like she's really just herself. She's very comfortable. I mean, they were like lovers too, which I found out.
Which is, I did not know that. Wow.
Yeah, for a time. He says it in his interview. She's so comfortable with him. And I feel like she just sits there and just talks to him like she would with someone really close to her. And so I've really enjoyed watching those interviews, and just that whole documentary has made me feel like I know her better. But those live performances of hers where you can watch her singing her songs at the time, I feel like that's been honestly my most favorite thing to kind of get inside of her.
Yeah, but no, the best way, I'm sure, to study her is to watch her every movement. Do you have to imitate her accent as well in the...
Luckily I'm from Texas, so I kind of just put it a little further up, so it's a little scratchier, but, you know, I don't want to sound like a cartoon. I just kind of, the one thing that I do change is I say man, a lot. She said man at the end of every sentence, and it's not just man, like I would say it. She's like, man, right? Yeah, man.
You got it.
Where it scratches through. So we say man a lot, and that's probably the biggest change to my voice, but I'm definitely not trying to like get up there and be a cartoon, because then you can't relate to me. And one of my favorite things about her is that she was just so relatable and natural. So
I mentioned, do you plan to continue to portray her? Do you think this is a role you'd like to continue to pursue, or to go into something different?
Yeah, I mean, ask me after I've done it, you know, 12 times in a row, but I think I can. I think that I'd love to. And I mean, I've witnessed it before when I did it last time. People love this show, so there's no reason it shouldn't be done in every city. And as long as I can do it, I would love to be there.
That's great. Well, thank you so much again for joining us today at Beat Cafe, and we look forward to seeing you on the stage. And we're going to close out by hearing a song by Janis, the one where she directly mentions a Louisiana city, Baton Rouge, of course.
All right.
Thank you again, Leslie. Do appreciate
really it. Really nice to talk to you.
And we'll see you on stage.
Say hi to me after the show.
I will.
Nice Goodbye. To meet you.
You bet.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train. And I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed a diesel down just before it rained and rode us all the way into New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues. Windshield wipers slapping time, Bobby's hand in mine. We sang every song that Javi knew. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, I mean nothing, honey, if it ain't free. No, no. Yeah, feeling good was easy, love, when he sang the blues. You know, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough. to mine. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing, that's all that Bobby left me. Money feeling good was easy lying when he sang the blues. Hey, feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby.
Got you covered, New Orleans, WHIV-FM, and streaming 24/7 at WHIVFM.org, WHIVLP 102.3 FM, New Orleans.
So I'm pleased today to be joined by Shannon McNally. She is a recording artist with numerous albums to her name, and her most recent album is a tribute to Waylon Jennings. It's called The Waylon Sessions. I want to welcome you, Shannon. Thank you for joining us today on The Beat Cafe.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Great. So Shannon, tell me what drew you to Waylon Jennings and how this album came to be.
I think it was a process of growth. And not to get all weird or anything, but just sort of a massive moment of self-acceptance, like a weird sort of coming out, you know, I'm coming out. I'm like, hey, y'all take that. I got some Waylon Jennings in me. No, I just had this idea one day. I mean, I've listened to Waylon my whole life. I grew up with him. The same as Willie Nelson. They were ubiquitous when I was a kid. I grew up on Long Island and people seem to think that's Mars when it comes to music, you know, but New York, Long Island is still one of the biggest country music markets in the country. And it really always has been. And the 70s to me there was a lot of country music. Country music was pop music in the 70s, you know, when I was a little kid and the Dixie Hazard and all that stuff. And I was a little kid, you know, and it's the Keystone Cops is really what Dixie Hazard was. But without looking at, you know, 70s television through a modern lens too closely, it was very good natured, you know, it was very good natured. And Willie and Waylon and those guys, they were really kind of ahead of the curve on a lot of levels. You know, I like to say I grew up on Sesame Street and that a lot of the way I view life, you know, came from Sesame Street. And of course, Waylon Jennings was all in the Muppet movies and Willie Nelson is a Muppet. So the two of them always have struck a chord in me about sort of what's fair and what's right. And they had such a wonderful sense of humor, and they had such a direct way of telling the truth. And, you know, they were pretty ballsy socially growing, you know, and so I always liked that. You know, they had a nice sense of justice. And Waylon, of course, I mean, to me now, just had made all these records, and when I had moved to Nashville, I'd been called country everywhere I'd lived before, you know, and with a little bit of disdain or a little bit of like, oh, that's kind of country, you know. I was country when country wasn't cool, as the song goes. But when I lived in LA, you know, that was like when I did David Letterman, like the label, the guy who ran Capitol Records called me, and all he said was, it's too country. And that was it, you know, they pulled the record. Which it wasn't country at all. By any stretch of the imagination was it country, except they had acoustic guitars and pedal steel in it. It was Americana, was the precursor to Americana. And when I think of Waylon Jennings, he emboldens me in this way. You know, he makes me feel very comfortable to be bold. When I had moved to Nashville, I suddenly, you know, I had lived in LA, I had lived in New Orleans. And in LA, everything was very sort of pop driven, even if you were coming at it from the Tom Petty and Heartbreakers, Fleetwood Mac side of things, you know, which was like bearable pop, you know, pop that you like, pop that still had substance and story and stuff like that, and really great guitar tones, you know. Then I lived in New Orleans, and New Orleans is its own thing. And New Orleans, of course, is you know, there's a lot more sort of New Orleans R&B, and it's the origins of the blues, and it's the origins of so much American music, but it swings in its own way. You know, it's got its own sense of center. Dr. John and the Meters and Alan Toussaint and all that stuff's under the undercurrent of everything. Snooks Eaglin, it all has this little sideways glance to it, you know. I appreciate all of it. And the New Orleans stuff is down deep in me. Like, I don't need to reaffirm that. Like, that's there. But when I got to Nashville, I moved here 4 or 5 years ago, because that's where the business is and that's where the industry is. And it just, you know how the world works, the universe works, is when it's just time, you end up where you're supposed to be. And so it was the next step on my path. And suddenly, everybody was country. Even people I don't think are country were being called country. And people, I'm like, that's not country, you know? You want to hear country? I'll show you country. And it was kind of like, I felt free. I felt really freer. I don't know if that was just getting older, you know, being a different place in my life, like a little more just, you know, not doubting, not needing anybody's permission, or I don't need anybody to agree with me. You know, musically speaking, I've never really needed anybody to agree with me, but you always kind of hope they do, because you want them to, you know, listen to it and you want it to groove them. But the Waylon stuff, you know, I loved how even for country music, he's still way on the outside. He's an outsider, you know, he's always been an outsider. You know, it's like cowboys and Indians, he's both, you know. And that's what I really like about Waylon Jennings, is he's equal parts, you know, cowboy, but he's also an Indian, you know. So he's a proper hombre, you know. He's like a living Elmore Leonard novel. And
course, you know, he was, of course, branded among the outlaws, you know, people who kind of shook up the system in Nashville, decided to do their own thing. Would you consider yourself an outlaw? Would you consider yourself in any way in that vein? Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, I think I would. After all of these years of just kind of doing whatever the hell I wanted to do, that's really the basis of the term outlaw. Outlaw had nothing to do with petty crime or, you know, Dukes of Hazzard silly stuff where they got, you know, a bundle of weed in the trunk, or stealing cars, or any of that silly stuff, or, you know, spending the night in the drunk tank. None of that's not what they're talking about as far as being an outlaw. An outlaw is somebody who, you know, just travels to the beat of their own drum, and but still, you know, but still is part of the collective. You know, it's just that they sort of expand the lines of,
you know. Well, they managed to obviously buck the system, but still draw enormous fan base, and
albums. Yeah, they recreated the system in their own likeness, you know, and that's what that's so great about the two of them, about Willie and Waylon. There's, of course, there's other outlaws, but nobody really did it as well as the two of them. But, you know, and it has something to do with Texas. The Texas-Tennessee relationship is amusing to me, you know. It's its own thing. It's funny. States have their own interrelationships. Now that I've lived in so many states, you know, it's like Mississippi and Alabama have their own thing. Florida and Texas have their own thing. Texas and Tennessee, they have their own thing. New York and California, they got their own thing. So, you know, but it's, yeah, they bucked the system, but they made the system go with them. Mm. They didn't so much buck the system as they said, yeah, but it would be so much better if we did it like this. And that's what they did. And they made a lot of money doing it, and they sold a lot of records, and they've been, you know, and they did it their way.
Indeed. Now, I know before you embarked on the Waylon sessions, you did consult with Jesse Coulter, Waylon's widowed wife now. What was it like approaching her, and what was her reaction?
She couldn't have been better, man. She was the best. I recorded the record before I talked to her. I recorded all 4 days, and I didn't tell anybody I was going in to do it because I didn't want to hear anybody's opinion of the matter, and I didn't want to get talked out of it. So I had a slamming band, you know, really an authoritative band guys I just knew were gonna do it right. But I was scared going in to do it. I thought, this is crazy, you know, this might not go well. I mean, this is a very man, and I'm sort of a very you know, I get a lot of credit for being this like tough girl, but I'm all girl. I'm girl, you know. I'm straight girl. I grew up in, you know, I grew up in the 80s on all those silly movies too, so I'm girl, you know, and this is a guy. And I wanted to get it right. And I wanted to simultaneously be respectful musically and not emasculate him in this weird way. You know, like, I wanted to keep it like has how I see it, how I feel it. But I kind of felt like intrinsically I could do that without, that wasn't too risky, but it was a little nerve-wracking. But anyway, we cut the whole record in 4 days, the bass tracks. And when I heard them back, I thought, "Oh, this is really good. This is real strong." So I got Jesse's number, and I called her and told her that I had made this record, and I know a lot of people had done Waylon Jennings tribute stuff, and I just wanted to ask permission. You know, what's the word? Permission, forgiveness, and permission. And you know, naturally she was like, okay, wonder how this is gonna go, you know. Oh, you did what? Okay, well, send it to me and I'll listen to it. So I sent it to her, and she listened to it, and she called me up, and she said, and this is before I had all the all my guest backup vocals on it, you know. And she called me up and she said, "Sister, that was bold. That was really bold." And she said, "But I think Waylon would love it." She said, "You got it just right. You nailed it on the head. Everything grooves right. It's big. It's very honest. It's real sort of macho in this ladylike way. And I love it. And I think Waylon would love it." Actually, she said, "I think Waylon would be tickled." And I said, "Well, that's good enough for me." I said, and then I asked her if she'd sing on it. And she said, yes.
Wow. Now, which song did she sing on?
Out Among the Stars.
What a beautiful compliment, though, that you must have been over the moon when you heard that.
I was pretty happy. Oh, yeah, I was pretty happy. You can't help but have your heart out on your sleeve when you do something like this, because it is a pretty big statement one way or the other. Especially, I'd never heard a woman sing any of this stuff, and I didn't want it to come off in some kind of weird, you know, and you're talking, this is his wife of many, many years. So, you know, I don't mean, I really meant it very respectfully, you know, and obviously I admired the man, and, you know, he was a true rock star and really handsome and glamorous in this very tough way. I mean, hard not to think he was attractive, you know, but simultaneously, I just really respected him and wanted to put those boots on for a little bit and just see what it felt like to kind of walk around the earth as, you know, a handsome, dark-haired Texan man who could pretty much say and do whatever he wanted and get away with it.
Indeed. We're going to take a brief break, a pause for the cause here at WHIV, and I'll be back with Shannon McNally. And we're back at Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson. I'm joined today by Shannon McNally, a vocalist who lived in New Orleans previously, is now based in Nashville. She's recently released a new album, The Waylon Sessions, devoted to the music of Waylon Jennings. Shannon, I want to go back to your early years as a singer. I read that you were a busker in Paris. That's a long way from Paris to Nashville. What took you to Paris?
I've been everywhere. School, you know. I have a 4-year degree from Franklin Marshall College. I did my junior year abroad in Paris. And so I spent a lot of time in the Paris metro, which is pretty substantial metro. It's a subway. Mm. And it's pretty huge. It's kind of like New York City. They have a lot of buskers, but it's a serious business. And you have to register, and you have to have a little ID card that says you're a busker and stuff. I didn't go quite that far. They have a lot of gypsies who would get these cards, and they would walk around the subway cards dancing and singing, and, you know, it's pretty cool. And then there was a lot of Andeans, you know, from Bolivia and stuff like that, and they would sing, and they had all the pipes, the pan pipes, and so they were kind of a lot of people from all over the world doing, and people playing the violin and doing all kinds of stuff, and they had their regular spots, and, you know, you would see them every day, and they worked like a job. I think just for tips though. So I tried it, you know. I didn't have an ID card. I didn't go that far. But I did get up and sing in the subways sometimes. And I thought, wow, I mean, like, how I'm actually very introverted. So it was just sort of a little test to myself, you know. It's taken me years to not be as introverted as I, you know, to sort of come out of it. I'm still a pretty big introvert. But it was just something that I used to practice not being quite as introverted, you know, not quite as shy. It seemed like a pretty safe environment because people were doing it, you know, and it's a subway. If you're terrible, it's going to stop and everybody's going to get off. And you're never going to see you again. The audience
comes and goes. Yes.
The audience keeps moving. Yeah.
Audience keeps moving.
Yeah.
What kind of music were you playing as a buster?
Oh, whatever little songs were I knew at the time. The first song that I learned how to play on guitar was actually was Down on the Corner. After that, the one that I learned so that I could sing and play at the same time was a Sinead O'Connor song off her first record. And I can't actually remember what it was called, but I remember it was in C, and it was very, and I knew all the chords, and I was like, oh, this is, you know, if I just play this really slowly, I might be able to play it and sing it at the same time. So I'd like to thank Sinead O'Connor, because that was, you know, I can't remember what song it was.
A good training either way, I think.
Yeah. So that, those kinds of songs. Yeah. I used to sing the coal miner song that was, I am a miner, coal miner, the Cowboy Junkie song. I think it was called Coal Dust Miner or... Mm-hmm. Anyway, terrible. I can't. Let's say I was singing Sinead O'Connor and Cowboy Junkie songs.
Gotcha.
Those were my first songs.
You are, of course, not just a singer, but a songwriter. I'm curious, where do your inspirations for songs come from?
Well, I wish they came a little more frequently, but and I'm not entirely positive, but I think it's just saying things that you haven't heard said before, in a way, or they just come through you, right? You know, they come through you. And for me, songs kind of tend to come through all at once. Not like I have them in a dream and I sit down and write them out, but once I sit down and actually start writing, they tend to come pretty much all at one shot. And then, you know, maybe I tweak it later on, but I generally tweak it later on, or definitely then during the recording process. I love to rewrite things as they're being sung. But I think it's, you know, sometimes my songs can be a little vague, or I've been told that they're vague. I know, you know, I get a little bored with songs that are so obvious. They are so clearly about something specific that I just go, you know, that you don't need me for that. There's a lot of other people can write those songs, but sometimes it's just a feeling, you know, that you want to transfer a feeling from myself to somebody else.
Obviously New Orleans left a very strong impression on you. One of the things I most vividly remember in the past was when you read a eulogy at Dr. John's funeral, which is very emotional. How did that all come to be?
Mac and I had been friends for a long time, and the day he passed away, I had gotten, or the next day, I was in San Francisco, and I had gotten a text message from a very dear friend of his, a lady, and she sort of needed, she and he had been very, very close, but she didn't really have anybody else to talk to about him and just what a loss it was. And she was very upset. So she called me, and I didn't know her that well, but I knew, you know, we had met and I knew who she was, and she really needed to hear something, you know, because Mac was such a medicine man. You know, he dealt so heavily with the spiritual world that she just didn't know where to turn to get enough of that right then, you know, in this incredible moment of him passing into the spirit world. She felt like she didn't have anybody to talk to specifically about that. You know, people wanted to talk about the nuts and bolts of funerals and this and that. And she was very worried that the funeral wouldn't be what Mac would want, that it wouldn't be sort of heavy enough and joy, you know, like that there wouldn't be enough spirit. And so we talked about Mac and the kind of funeral that we would hope for him, because he was such a unique person and so incredibly spiritual. You know, he really did sort of have one foot in the afterlife his whole life. And I knew the family as well. And so they asked me if, you know, would I speak at the service? And of course I said yes, which was terrifying an idea. But I went down to New Orleans, and, you know, they had a sort of an early viewing, you know, and which I didn't actually go to. I went when he, you know, I sat with him while he was in his casket. It was closed. Before everybody got there, I sat with him for a while, and before the service really started, and really tried to collect my thoughts and think about what I would say and why he was so important to me and what really summed him up. And, you know, I was almost like asking his opinion, you know, I mean, not in some weird clairvoyant way, but or maybe in some weird clairvoyant way, I don't know. But what really struck me in those moments of really focusing my thoughts on him and just sort of what a success his life had been in so many ways and how particular it was. And just, you know, that one, he was dedicated to disobedience.
It's a good way to phrase it.
He didn't do anything regulation. You know, and I think that, you know, he had dyslexia, he was dyslexic. So I think, you know, dyslexics tend to be, they make up their own systems for doing things in the world. My dad's dyslexic and they tend to, you know, they have to delegate a lot, you know, because they have to make up their own systems for getting through the world because they're making it up sometimes. But one, Dr. John definitely had, he was dedicated to disobedience. And I've known a number of other people like that, but he was really a pirate in that sense. And two, like, you know, the voodoo for him was real. That wasn't dress up, you know, at all, ever. He knew he was very conscious of the day he was going to die and what was going to happen after that and where he was going to go. And so he, you know, that whole routine, it wasn't just shtick. He believed it, you know, the Mardi Gras Indians to him, that they were talking. You know, he talked to the other world. He was in it. He was in the other world as much as he was here. So, and I thought that was a very comforting idea, you know, because a lot of people without him around, how do you sort of keep, you know, how do you keep things weird? How do you keep things not really platonic and processed? And, you know, he was one of those people that kept things interesting. He personified the pilot light that is New Orleans, and that thing that's a little scary. And, you know, it's the spirits that talk through drums. And, you know, New Orleans is such a heavy, deep place, and it's pretty dark. Now, you want to really go there, you can't be scared. You got to be brave, because you're really talking about a pirate port town, the top of the Caribbean. You're talking about a slave ships and, you know, slave markets and music from Africa and massacres. And you're talking about a pretty deep, bloody place. And so that's a portal for, and but then as much as darkness and mayhem and murder, you're also talking about, you know, lust and joy and all of your sensory perceptions, which, you know, much more sensuous in New Orleans. Everything's allowed to taste better, and you're allowed to get horny, and you're allowed to live out all your fantasies, and you're allowed to do it in public, and you're allowed to get, you know, so drunk that you fall asleep in the gutter, and like the next morning they find you and they have to hose you off and you're gross. Like, it's for people, it's a kind of baptism by, you know, it's a kind of baptism that happens in New Orleans. And so, you know, and Mac represented that to a lot of people. And it was a cleansing thing for a lot of people. That's why people come to New Orleans, to get cleansed of their regular BS. And they're having to play it safe and play nice, and they can let their spirit out. It's all Mardi Gras, you know, it's kind of Mardi Gras every day in New Orleans. And that let your spirit out, that's the part about Mac that he really encouraged in people. And so, you know, it's his dedication to disobedience. It was his refusal to do anything regulation, as he would say, and that he really always kept one foot in the spirit world, and that he was really talking to the spirits, and he was making decisions based on the afterlife and the beauty of that, all of that is. And that life has an uphill and a downhill. And either you do the uphill in the beginning and then the downhill, and, you know, which is what most people do. Most people work their whole lives. They play by the game, the rules, and then they retire and then they do whatever they want. Mac did it the other way around. He did the downhill first. He had all his fun. He did bad things. He made all the music he wanted. He slept with all the women he wanted to sleep with. He ate whatever he wanted to. He was a pirate, you know? But so then, you know, he had to do the uphill. And so I thought those were things that, you know, that might be important anyway,
well, those are some of the most eloquent and most descriptive words I've ever heard about New Orleans. And of course, about Dr. John. You really did sum him up very, very well. So we're going to jump back to Nashville, of course.
Yeah. Where none of that happens.
So I thought we might conclude the show by playing one of the songs from your album, I've Always Been Crazy, which is truly one of Waylon's anthems. Tell me, when you're giving voice to those songs, what does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, it's right there in the lyrics. It's a very simple lyric. I've always been crazy with one foot over the line, winding up someplace, one step ahead or behind. I ain't been so easy, but I guess I shouldn't complain. I've always been crazy, but it's kept me from going insane. You know, I mean, by all accounts, I should have, I was a nice Irish girl from Long Island. I should have married some guy and had a pizza parlor and, you know, had a bunch of kids and just took them to the beach in the summers and, you know, go to the firehouse. I should have just been a nice local girl, but I just wasn't built that way, you know, and everybody else I knew, they all got married at, in their early 20s, and they started having babies, and they got jobs, and they bought houses, and they did the whole thing, and I didn't do any of that. You know, I just sort of set off and kind of made my own path, but I wasn't trying to be outlawish or anything. I just found things interesting, and I went in that direction, you know, and I love where I'm from. I just didn't stay there, you know.
Well, we hope you keep going in that direction because we are big fans of your music, and I'm eager to share this song with all of our listeners. So thank you again, Shannon. It was such a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me, and I really do appreciate you playing the record and everything.
And we look forward to seeing you back in New Orleans as soon as you can. All right. Thanks again.
All right.
I've been busted.